This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose.
Chapter 1. Youth, 1774 to 1792. From the west-facing window of the room in which Meriwether Lewis was born on August 18, 1774, one could look out at Rockfish Gap in the Blue Ridge Mountains, an opening to the west that invited exploration. The Virginia Piedmont of 1774 was not the frontier. That had extended beyond the Allegheny chain of mountains, and a cultivated plantation life was nearly a generation old, but it wasn't far removed. Traces of the old buffalo trail that led up Rockfish River to the Gap still remained. Deer were exceedingly plentiful, black bear common. An exterminating war was being waged against wolves. Beaver were on every stream. Flocks of turkeys thronged the woods. In the fall and spring, ducks and geese darkened the rivers. Lewis was born in a place where the West invited exploration, but the East could provide education and knowledge, where the hunting was magnificent, but plantation society provided refinement and enlightenment, where he could learn wilderness skills while sharpening his wits about such matters as surveying, politics, natural history, and geography. The West was very much on Virginians' minds in 1774, even though the big news that year was the Boston Tea Party, the introduction of resolutions in the House of Burgesses in support of Massachusetts, the dissolution of the Burgesses by the Royal Governor Lord Dunmore, and a subsequent meeting at Raleigh Tavern of the dissolved Burgesses, whose committee of correspondents sent out letters calling for a general congress of the American colonies. In September, the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia, and revolution was underway. Lord Dunmore was a villain in the eyes of the revolutionaries. He was eventually forced to flee Virginia and take up residence on a British warship. But in January 1774, he had done Virginia a big favor by organizing an offensive into the Ohio country by Virginia militia. The Virginians goaded Shawnee, Ottawa, and other tribes into what became Lord Dunmore's War, which ended with the Indians defeated. They ceded hunting rights in Kentucky to the Virginians and agreed to unhindered access to and navigation on the Ohio River. Within 6 months, the Transylvania Company sent out Daniel Boone to blaze a trail through the Cumberland Gap to the bluegrass country of Kentucky. Meanwhile, the British government, in the Quebec Act of 1774, moved to stem the flow of Virginians across the mountains by extending the boundary of Canada south to the Ohio River. This cut off Virginia's western claims, threatened to spoil the hopes and schemes of innumerable land speculators, including George Washington, and established a highly centralized crown-controlled government with special privileges for the Catholic Church, provoking fear that French Canadians, rather than Protestant Virginians, would rule in the Ohio Valley. This was one of the so-called intolerable acts that spurred the revolution. Meriwether Lewis was born on the eve of revolution into a world of conflict between Americans and the British government for control of the Trans-Appalachian West in a colony whose western ambitions were limitless, a colony that was leading the surge of Americans over the mountains, and in a county that was a nursery of explorers. His family had been part of the western movement from the beginning. Thomas Jefferson described Lewis's forebears as one of the distinguished families of Virginia, and among the earliest. The first Lewis to come to America had been Robert, a Welshman and an officer in the British Army. The family coat of arms was Omni Solum Forti Patria Est, or All Earth is to a Brave Man His Country. An alternate translation is Everything the Brave Man Does is for His Country. Robert arrived in 1635 with a grant from the king for 33,333 1/3 acres of Virginia land. He had numerous progeny, including Colonel Robert Lewis, who was wonderfully successful on the Virginia frontier of the 18th century in Albemarle County. On his death, Colonel Lewis was wealthy enough to leave all 9 of his children with substantial plantations. His fifth son, William, inherited 1,896 acres and slaves and a house, Locust Hill, a rather rustic log home, but very comfortable and filled with things of value, including much table silver. It was just 7 miles west of Charlottesville, within sight of Monticello. One of the Lewis men, an uncle of Meriwether Lewis's father, was a member of the King's Council. Another, Fielding Lewis, married a sister of George Washington. Still another relative, Thomas Lewis, accompanied Jefferson's father, Peter, on an expedition in 1746 into the Northern Neck, between the Potomac and the Rappahannock. Thomas was the first Lewis to keep a journal of exploration. He had a gift for vivid descriptions, of horses tumbling over rocks and precipices, of cold, rain, and near starvation. He wrote of exultation over killing one old bear and three cubs. He described a mountain area where they were so often in the outmost danger, this terrible place was called Purgatory. One river was so treacherous they named it Styx. From the dismal appearance of the place being sufficient to strict terror in any human creature. In 1769, William Lewis, then 31 years old, married his cousin, 22-year-old Lucy Meriwether. The Meriwether family was also Welsh and also land rich. By 1730, the family held a tract near Charlottesville of 17,952 acres. The coat of arms was Vi et Concilio, or Force and Counsel. George R. Gilmer, later a governor of Georgia, wrote of the family, "None ever looked at or talked with the Meriwether, but he heard something which made him look or listen again." Jefferson said of Colonel Nicholas Meriwether, Lucy's father, "He was the most sensible man I ever knew." He had served as commander of a Virginia regiment in Braddock's disastrous campaign of 1755. The Lewis and Meriwether families had long been close-knit and interrelated. Indeed, there were 11 marriages joining Lewis's and Meriwether's between 1725 and 1774. Nicholas Meriwether II, 1667 to 1744, was the great-grandfather of Lucy Meriwether and the grandfather of William Lewis. The marriage of Lucy and William combined two bloodlines of unusual strength and some weaknesses. According to Jefferson, the family was subject to hypochondriac affections. It was a constitutional disposition in all the nearer branches of the family. Despite William Lewis's tendency toward hypochondria, or what Jefferson at other times called melancholy and would later be called depression, Jefferson described his neighbor and friend as a man of good sense, integrity, bravery, enterprise, and remarkable bodily powers. A year after their marriage, William and Lucy Lewis had their first child, a daughter they named Jane. Meriwether Lewis was born in 1774. 3 years later, a second son, Reuben, was born. In 1775, war broke out. Jefferson noted that, when it came, William Lewis was happily situated at home with a wife and young family, and a fortune placed him at ease. Nevertheless, he left all to aid in the liberation of his country from foreign usurpations. Like General Washington, he served without pay. Going Washington one better, he bore his own expenses as his patriotic contribution to his country. Meriwether Lewis scarcely knew his father, for Lieutenant Lewis was away making war for most of the first 5 years of his son's life. He served as commander of one of the first regiments raised in Virginia, enlisting in July 1775. By September, he was a first lieutenant in the Albemarle County Militia. When the unit integrated with the Continental Line, he became a lieutenant in the Regulars. In November 1779, Lieutenant Lewis spent a short leave with his family at Cloverfields, a Meriwether family plantation where his wife Lucy had grown up. He said his goodbyes, swung onto his horse, and rode to the Secretary's ford of the Rivanna River, swollen in flood. Attempting to cross, his horse was swept away and drowned. Lewis managed to swim ashore and hiked back to Cloverfields, drenched. Pneumonia set in, and in 2 days he was dead. People in the late 18th century were helpless in matters of health. They lived in constant dread of sudden death from disease, plague, epidemic, pneumonia, or accident. Their letters always begin and usually end with assurances of the good health of the letter writer and a query about the health of the recipient. Painful as the death of an honored and admired father was to a son, it was a commonplace experience. What effect it may have had on Meriwether cannot be known. In any case, he was quickly swept up into his extended family. Nicholas Lewis, William Lewis's older brother, became Meriwether's guardian. He was a heroic figure himself. He had commanded a regiment of militia in an expedition in 1776 against the Cherokee Indians, who had been stirred up and supported by the British. Jefferson paid tribute to his bravery and said that Nicholas Lewis was endeared to all who knew him by his inflexible probity, courteous disposition, benevolent heart, and engaging modesty and manners. He was the umpire of all the private differences of his county, selected always by both parties. Less than 6 months after his father's death, another man came into Meriwether's life. On May 13, 1780, his mother married Captain John Marks. Virginia widows in those days commonly remarried as soon as possible, and family tradition has it that in marrying Captain Marks, she was following the advice of her first husband, given as he lay dying. Lucy Meriwether Lewis Marks was a remarkable woman. She bore 5 children, 2 by John Marks, John Hastings, born 1785, and Mary Garland, born 1788. She had a strong constitution. She buried 2 husbands and lived to be almost 86 years old. Jefferson called her a tender mother. She was slim, fragile in appearance, with light brown hair and hazel blue eyes, a refined face and a masterful eye. A family history described her. Her position as a head of a large family connection, combined with the Spartan ideas in those stirring times of discipline, developed in her a good deal of the autocrat. Yet she had much sweetness of character, was a devoted Christian, and full of sympathy for all sickness and trouble. Known far and wide for her medicinal remedies, she grew a special crop of herbs which she dispensed to her children, her slaves, and her neighbors. She also knew the medicinal properties of wild plants. She took care to teach her son all that she had learned about herbal remedies. Stern and Spartan though she may have been, her son loved her dearly. Although he was scarcely ever with her from age 14 on, he was a faithful and considerate correspondent. On March 31, 1805, he wrote her from Fort Mandan, 1,609 miles above the entrance of the Missouri, to relate to her some of his various adventures in ascending the river so far, and to inform her that he was about to set off into the unknown. "I feel the most perfect confidence that we shall reach the Pacific Ocean this summer." It was going to be easy, he wrote, because everyone in the party was in good health and excellent spirits, are attached to the enterprise and anxious to proceed. Still, mothers will worry, so he added, "You may expect me in Albemarle County, Virginia, about the last of next September, 12 months. I request that you will give yourself no uneasiness with respect to my fate, for I assure you that I feel myself perfectly as safe as I should do in Albemarle, and the only difference between 3,000 or 4,000 miles and 130 is that I cannot have the pleasure of seeing you as often as I did while I lived at Washington." The woman who inspired such concern and love was also capable of leading an expedition of her own into the wilderness, of running a plantation, of supervising at hog-killing time. When some drunken British officers burst into Locust Hill one evening, she grabbed her rifle down from its peg and drove them off. Another time, a hunting party from Locust Hill and neighboring plantations got separated from the dogs. The hounds brought a buck to bay on the lawn at Locust Hill. Lucy grabbed her rifle, rushed out, and shot it. When the crestfallen hunters returned empty-handed, the buck's hindquarters were already roasting over the fire. She had a county-wide reputation for her culinary talents. Jefferson was especially fond of her cured Virginia hams. His overseer recorded, "Every year I used to get a few for his special use." She had a small library, which she treasured. She valued it so much that she was careful to leave directions in her will for its equal division among her surviving children. "Her person was perfect," said one of her male acquaintances, "and her activity beyond her sex." Even as an old lady, Grandma Marks was seen riding about Albemarle on horseback to attend the sick. According to a contemporary, in her mid-70s, she retained refined features, a fragile figure, and a masterful eye. Georgia Governor George Gilmer described her, "She was sincere, truthful, industrious, and kind without limit." He added that Meriwether Lewis inherited the energy, courage, activity, and good understanding of his admirable mother. As a child, Meriwether absorbed a strong anti-British sentiment. This came naturally to any son of a patriot growing up during the war. It was reinforced by seeing a British raiding party led by Colonel Bannister Tarleton sweep through Albemarle in 1781. Jefferson recorded, "He destroyed all my growing crops of corn and tobacco. He burned all my barns containing the same articles of last year, having first taken what he wanted. He used, as was to be expected, all my stocks of cattle, sheep, and hogs for the sustenance of his army, and carried off all the horses capable of service. Of those too young for service, he cut the throats, and he burned all the fences on the plantation so as to leave it an absolute waste. He carried off also about 30 slaves." Tarleton also ordered all the county court records burned. This wanton act was roundly and rightly condemned by Reverend Edgar Woods in his 1932 history of Albemarle County. "It is hard to conceive any conduct in an army more outrageous, more opposed to the true spirit of civilization, and withal more useless in a military point of view, than the destruction of public archives." When Meriwether was 8 or 9 years old, his stepfather, Captain Marks, migrated with a number of Virginians to a colony being developed by General John Matthews on the Broad River in northeastern Georgia. Few details of this trek into the wilderness survive, but it is easy enough to imagine a wide-eyed boy on the march with horses, cattle, oxen, pigs, dogs, wagons, slaves, other children, adults, making camp every night, hunting for deer, turkey, and possum, fishing in the streams running across the route of march, watching and perhaps helping with the cooking, packing up each morning and striking out again, crossing through the Carolinas along the eastern edge of the mountains, getting a sense of the vastness of the country, and growing comfortable with life in the wilderness. Meriwether lived in Georgia for 3, perhaps 4 years. It was frontier country, and he learned frontier skills. He gloried in the experience. Jefferson later wrote that he was remarkable even in infancy for enterprise, boldness, and discretion. When only 8 years of age, he habitually went out in the dead of night, alone with his dogs, into the forest to hunt the raccoon and possum. In this exercise, no season or circumstance could obstruct his purpose, plunging through the winter's snows and frozen streams in pursuit of his object. At about this time, according to family legend, 8 or 9-year-old Meriwether was crossing a field with some friends, returning from a hunt. A vicious bull rushed him. His companions watched breathless as he calmly raised his gun and shot the bull dead. Another favorite family story about Meriwether at a young age concerned an Indian scare. When one of the cabins was attacked, the transplanted Virginians gathered at another for defense. Then they decided they were too few to defend it from a determined attack and fled for concealment to the forest. As dusk came on, one hungry, not very bright refugee started a fire to cook a meal. The fire attracted the Indians. A shot rang out. The women shouted alarms, men rushed for their rifles, something close to panic set in. In the general confusion and uproar, only 10-year-old Meriwether had sufficient presence of mind to throw a bucket of water over the fire to douse it, to prevent the Indians from seeing the whites silhouetted against the light of the fire. A family friend commented, "He acquired in youth hardy habits and a firm constitution. He possessed in the highest degree self-possession in danger." Curious and inquisitive, as well as cool-headed and courageous, he delighted his mother by asking questions about her herbs and about wild plants that she used as nostrums. He wanted to know the names and characteristics of the trees, bushes, shrubs, and grasses, of the animals, the fish, the birds, and the insects. He wanted to know the why as well as the way of things. He learned to read and write, and something of the natural world, from one of the adults in the Georgia community. An anecdote survived. When told that despite what he saw, the sun did not revolve around the earth, Meriwether jumped as high into the air as he could, then asked his teacher, "If the earth turns, why did I come down in the same place?" He wanted more knowledge. He could not get it in Georgia. And he was a youngster of considerable substance and responsibility, for under Virginia's laws of primogeniture, he had inherited his father's estate. This included a plantation of nearly 2,000 acres, 520 pounds in cash, 24 slaves, and 147 gallons of whiskey. Though it was being managed by Nicholas Meriwether, it would soon be Meriwether's to run. His mother agreed that he should return to Virginia at about age 13 to obtain a formal education and prepare himself for his management responsibilities. There were no public schools in 18th century Virginia. Planters' sons got their education by boarding with teachers, almost always preachers or parsons, who would instruct them in Latin, mathematics, natural science, and English grammar. Jefferson biographer Dumas Malone notes that the sons of the greater landowners had all the advantages and disadvantages that go with private instruction. The quality of this instruction was often high, but it naturally varied with the tutors who were available. These men were all overworked, their schools too crowded. Finding a place was difficult. Even with his guardian, Nicholas Lewis, and his father's friend, Thomas Jefferson, to help him, it took Meriwether some months, perhaps as long as a year, to become a formal student. His first extant letter, dated May 12, 1787, he addressed to his most loving mother. Apparently, he had not yet found a place. He began by complaining that he had no letter from his mother, then confessed, "What language can express the anxiety I feel to be with you when I sit down to write, but as it is now a thing impossible, I shall quit the subject and say nothing more about it." He was glad to report that all the Lewises and Meriwethers in Albemarle were in good health. He passed on a rumor that Cousin Thomas Meriwether is married, and asked if she knew anything about it. He concluded, "I live in hopes of receiving a letter from you by which, as the only means, I may be informed of your health and welfare. I enjoy my health at present, which I hope is your situation. I am your ever-loving son." Meriwether's next surviving letter to his mother, undated, written from Cloverfields, related family news and the complications he was encountering in trying to get into school. His brother-in-law, Edmund Anderson, who had married his older sister Jane in 1785 when she was 15, was preparing to go into business in Richmond and would have been there before this had not the smallpox broke out in that city, which rages with great violence, and until this disorder can be extirpated, they will continue where they are, i.e. in Hanover. Sister Jane and children are well. The children have grown very much, but I see no appearance of another. Parson Matthew Maury, son of one of Thomas Jefferson's teachers, was the man Meriwether wanted to study with, but so far he had not been able to get started. "I hope Reuben, his younger brother, still in Georgia, is at school, though I am not yet engaged in that pursuit myself," he wrote. Robert Lewis and myself applied to Mr. Maury soon after my return to Albemarle, who informed us that he could not take us by any means till next spring, and as what we would wish to learn would interfere so much with his Latin business, that he had rather not take us at all. Meriwether had therefore applied to Reverend James Waddell, but success was uncertain. "If we do not go to Mr. Waddell, we shall certainly go to one Mr. Williamson, a young Scotchman who teaches in about 10 miles of this place, and who was earnestly recommended both by Mr. Maury and Waddell. In this situation, I have now been waiting for this 3 weeks past." In the fall of 1787, Reuben came to Cloverfields for a visit. As he was leaving, he asked Meriwether to come to Georgia the following fall. On March 7, 1788, Meriwether wrote Reuben to say he could not make the visit. "By reason of my being at school, I set in with Parson Maury soon after you left me, with whom I continued till Christmas, and then I fully expected to have stayed 6 months longer at least, if not another year, but Cousin William D. Meriwether then said he did not think it worth while, as I had got well acquainted with the English grammar, and might learn the geography at home. Upon this, I concluded to stay at Uncle Peachy Gilmer's and to go to school to a master in the neighborhood in order to get acquainted with figures, where I am now stationed. He hated not being able to visit Georgia. "I should like very much to have some of your sport, fishing, and hunting," he told Reuben. But he was determined to improve himself and said he must be doing something that will no doubt be more to my advantage hereafter, that is, getting an education. In June 1788, Meriwether's guardian paid £7 for room, board, and tuition. In January 1789, he paid £13, and in July, another £2. That summer, Meriwether was able to go to Georgia for a visit. In the fall, he studied under Dr. Charles Everett. His schoolmate and cousin Peachy Gilmer, 5 years younger than Meriwether, hated Dr. Everett. According to Gilmer, he was afflicted with very bad health, of an atrabilious and melancholy temperament, peevish, capricious, and every way disagreeable. He invented cruel punishments for the scholars. His method of teaching was as bad as anything could be. He was impatient of interruption. We seldom applied for assistance, said our lessons badly, made no proficiency, and acquired negligent and bad habits. Young Gilmer described Meriwether as always remarkable for perseverance, which in the early period of his life seemed nothing more than obstinacy in pursuing the trifles that employ that age. A martial temper, great steadiness of purpose, self-possession, and undaunted courage. His person was stiff and without grace, bow-legged, awkward, formal, and almost without flexibility. His face was comely, and by many considered handsome. Meriwether loved to ramble, as Jefferson put it. Into the mountains, or to visit Jane and other relatives, or down to Georgia, a trip he made at least once on his own. Later in his life, he met his mother's half-joking complaints about his roving propensities with a laughing response that he had inherited this disposition from her. Albemarle County records show that Meriwether's guardian was meticulous. His accounts include the purchase of 1 pair knee buckles, 10 vest buttons, 2 hanks silk, 1 pin niff. There are numerous entries for pocket money. One arresting entry is for 1 quart whiskey for Negro wench. Another covers 1 quart rum and 1 pound sugar. Meriwether transferred in 1790 to Reverend James Waddell, who was a great contrast to the ill-tempered Everett. Meriwether called Waddell a very polite scholar. He wrote his mother in August, "I expect to continue here for 18 months or 2 years. Every civility is here paid to me and leaves me without any reason to regret the loss of a home of nearer connection. As soon as I complete my education, you shall certainly see me." In October 1791, he wrote his mother to report that he had received a letter from Uncle Thomas Gilmer, Peachy's father, "which gives most agreeable information of your welfare and my brother's assiduity and attention at school." He said he had just returned from a visit with his sister Jane, who had shown him a letter their mother had written that summer. From it he learned that Captain Marks had died, leaving his mother once again a widow, with Reuben plus the 2 younger children to care for. Mrs. Marks wanted Meriwether to come to Georgia to organize a move back to Virginia for her and her dependents. "I will with a great deal of cheerfulness do it," Meriwether wrote his mother, "but it will be out of my power sooner than 18 months or 2 years." He promised her she would always have a home at Locust Hill, and, "You may rely on my fidelity to render your situation as comfortable as it is in my power." In April 1792, Meriwether wrote his mother that he had learned from her letters to Jane that she was anxious to return to Virginia that spring. "This, together with my sister's impatience to see you, has induced me to quit school and prepare for setting out immediately." He had employed an artisan at Monticello to make a carriage for the trip. It would be ready by May 1st. Meriwether needed to purchase horses and collect some money. "If I cannot collect a sufficiency from the lands that are now due, I shall dispose of my tobacco for cash in order to be detained as little time as possible. I shall set out about the 15th of May. He did as promised, and by fall he had gone to Georgia, organized the move of his mother and her children and the slaves, animals, and equipment, and brought the whole back to Virginia, where he set up at Locust Hill and began his life as a planter and head of household. Thus ended Meriwether Lewis's scholarly career. What had he learned? Not enough Latin to use the language in his extensive later writings, nor any other foreign language. Not enough orthography ever to be comfortable or proficient with the spelling of English words. But then he lived in an age of freedom of spelling, a time when even so well-read and learned a man as Jefferson had trouble maintaining consistency in his spelling. He did develop a strong, sprightly, and flowing writing style. What he read can only be inferred from references in his writings, which indicate he read a little ancient history, some Milton and Shakespeare, and a smattering of recent British history. He was an avid reader of journals of exploration, especially those about the adventures of Captain James Cook. He got his figures down pretty well, along with a solid base in botany and natural history. He picked up all he could about geography. He had achieved the educational level of the well-rounded Virginian, who was somewhat familiar with the classics, reasonably current with philosophy. Only in the field of plantation affairs was he expected to be a specialist, and to that end Lewis now set out. He may have done so with some regret, for he valued education highly. All his life he kept after Reuben and his half-brother, John Marks, and half-sister, Mary Marks, to make every effort and meet every expense to further their educations. The last paragraph of his March 31, 1805 letter to his mother, written from Fort Mandan, far up the Missouri River, reads, "I must request of you, before I conclude this letter, to send John Marks to the college at Williamsburg, as soon as it shall be thought that his education has been sufficiently advanced to fit him for that seminary. For you may rest assured that as you regard his future prosperity, you had better make any sacrifice of his property than suffer his education to be neglected or remain incomplete." Perhaps as an 18-year-old he wished to continue his education, to attend the seminary at William and Mary, but it could not be. He was responsible for his mother, his brother, John and Mary Marks, the slaves at Locust Hill, his inheritance. Instead of book learning at William and Mary, he was destined to learn from the school of the plantation. At age 18, he was the head of a small community of about 24 slaves and nearly 2,000 acres of land. His lessons from now on would be in management, in soils, crops, distillery, carpentry, blacksmithing, shoemaking, weaving, coopering, timbering, in killing, dressing, and skinning cattle and sheep, preserving vegetables and meats, repairing plows, harrows, saws, and rifles, caring for horses and dogs, treating the sick, and the myriad of other tasks that went into running a plantation. At 18 years, he was on his own. He had traveled extensively across the southern part of the United States. He had shown himself to be a self-reliant, self-contained, self-confident teenager, and was a young man who took great pride in his perseverance and steadiness of purpose, as Peachy Gilmer had put it. His health was excellent, his physical powers were outstanding, he was sensitive and caring about his mother and his family. He was started. Chapter 2. Planter, 1792-1794. Foaled, not born, Virginia planters were said to be. They would go 5 miles to catch a horse in order to ride 1 mile afterward. In a country of vast estates, without cities or public transportation of any kind, with plantation seats far apart, riding was not a matter of sport or diversion, but of necessity. Planters spent much, if not most, of every working day on the back of a horse. Good horsemanship was taken for granted among the gentry. They had to be experts in the judging, feeding, breeding, and care of horses. From the time he was able to sit astride a horse, Meriwether Lewis was a fine, fearless rider. He became an excellent judge of horses and an expert in their care. Jefferson, believing that the taming of the horse had resulted in the degeneracy of the human body, urged the young to walk for exercise. Lewis took his advice and became a great hiker, with feet as tough as his butt. As a boy and young man, he went barefoot, in the Virginia manner. Jefferson's grandson claimed not to have worn shoes until he was 10. According to Jefferson, the young Lewis hunted barefoot in the snow. Like riding and hiking, dancing was taken for granted. Indeed, dancing was little short of a social necessity. "Virginians are of genuine blood," said one traveler. "They will dance or die." Like Jefferson, Lewis learned to dance the minuet, reels, and country dances at Reverend Maury's school. One diarist wrote in the year of Lewis's birth, "Any young gentleman traveling through the colony is presumed to be acquainted with dancing, boxing, playing the fiddle, and small sword, and cards." There is no evidence that Lewis learned to fiddle, but he knew the rest of the list. By no means were all Virginia planters or their sons paragons of virtue. If there was high-minded and learned political talk around the table, and much idealism and protestation of devotion to the common good, there also were temptations often too strong for healthy, wealthy young men to resist. Jefferson's father died when he was a boy. Decades later, in a letter to his grandson, Jefferson wrote in a famous passage, "When I recollect that at 14 years of age the whole care and direction of myself was thrown on myself entirely, without a relative or friend qualified to advise or guide me, and recollect the various sorts of bad company with which I associated from time to time, I am astonished I did not turn off with some of them, and become as worthless to society as they were. From the circumstances of my position, I was often thrown into the society of horse racers, card players, fox hunters, scientific and professional men, and of dignified men. And many a time I asked myself, in the enthusiastic moment of the death of a fox, the victory of a favorite horse, the issue of a question eloquently argued at the bar, or in the great council of the nation, well, which of these kinds of reputation should I prefer? That of a horse jockey? A fox hunter? An orator? Or the honest advocate of my country's rights?" Quite possibly, Jefferson talked to Lewis in the same Polonius-like style in which he wrote his grandson. Certainly, Lewis had thoughts similar to those expressed by Jefferson. On his 31st birthday, Lewis wrote in a famous passage, "This day I completed my 31st year. I reflected that I had as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race, or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence, and now sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended." He resolved, "In future, to live for mankind, as I have heretofore lived for myself." Such high-blown, idealized language, and the sentiments it reflected, along with that heartfelt resolve to do better, was characteristic of the Virginia gentry. It was almost a convention, a part of the social standard, like good manners. A Virginia gentleman was expected to be hospitable and generous, courteous in his relations with his peers, chivalrous toward women, and kind to his inferiors. There was a high standard of politeness. Jefferson once remarked that politeness was artificial good humor, a valuable preservative of peace and tranquility. Wenching and other debauchery, heavy drinking and similar personal vices were common enough, but as long as they did not interfere with relations between members of the gentry, they were condoned. The unpardonable sins were lying and meanness of spirit. Along with his perseverance, all his life Lewis prided himself on his honesty. These qualities were important for his self-esteem. His word, written and spoken, was his bond. A less admirable part of the code of the Virginia gentleman was the drinking, which could be excessive. One English traveler just after the Revolution described his perception of the typical Albemarle planter. "He rises about 8 o'clock, drinks what he calls a julep, which is a large glass of rum sweetened with sugar, then walks, or more generally rides, round his plantation, views his stock, inspects his crops, and returns about 10 o'clock to breakfast on cold meat or ham, fried hominy, toast, and cider. About 12 or 1 he drinks a toddy to create him an appetite for dinner, which he sits down to at 2 o'clock. He commonly drinks toddy till bedtime. During all this time he is neither drunk nor sober, but in a state of stupefaction. When he attends the courthouse or some horse race or cockfight, he gets so egregiously drunk that his wife sends a couple of Negroes to conduct him safe home. One may doubt that this planter was as typical as the Englishman asserted, but still regret that such men were among the contemporaries of the teenaged master of Locust Hill. Plantation management required attention to detail and sharp observation. In these areas, Lewis excelled. Jefferson described him as an assiduous and attentive farmer, observing with minute attention all plants and insects he met with. Lewis did not plant or harvest with his own hands. No member of the Virginia gentry did. When Jefferson or Lewis or any other slave owner said he had planted such and so, or that he had built this fence or that building, he did not mean to imply that he had done it with his own hands. His slaves did the work. "It is the poor Negroes who alone work hard," one traveler commented, "and I am sorry to say, fair hard. Incredible is the fatigue which the poor wretches undergo, and it is wonderful that nature should be able to support it." Lewis was successful at adding land to his holdings, something also critical to a Virginia planter. He ran Locust Hill and, in addition, acquired an 800-acre tract on the Red River in Montgomery County, took title to 180 acres of land that had belonged to Captain Marks, and secured another parcel in Clark County. Such constant expansion was critical because the Virginia plantation of the day was incredibly wasteful. The low ground or inferior bottom land was planted to corn to provide food for slaves and animals. Fertile land, identified by hardwood growth, was saved for tobacco. The planters had their slaves gird large trees and leave the trees to die while plowing lightly around them. Slaves created hills for tobacco with a hoe, without bothering to remove the trees. After three annual crops of tobacco, these fields grew wheat for a year or so before being abandoned and allowed to revert to pine forest. The planters let their stock roam wild, made no use of animal manure, and practiced only the most rudimentary crop rotation. Meanwhile, the planters moved their slaves to virgin lands and repeated the process. The system allowed the planters to use to the maximum the two things in which they were really rich, land and slaves. Tobacco, their only cash crop, was dependent on an all but unlimited quantity of each. The Virginians' lust for land and their resulting rage for speculation can only be marveled at. Before the Revolution, George Washington owned tens of thousands of acres in the Tidewater and Piedmont and over 63,000 acres of Trans-Appalachia. He wanted more. Jefferson inherited more than 5,000 acres in the Piedmont from his father. He wanted more. From his wife, he got another 11,000 acres. And though he was a substantial landowner, he was not a great one by Virginia standards. Tobacco wore out land so fast there could never be enough, but tobacco never brought in enough money to allow planters to get ahead. Their speculation in land was done on credit and promises and warrants, not cash, so they were always land rich and cash poor. Small wonder Jefferson was obsessed with securing an empire for the United States. Tobacco culture represented an all-out assault on the environment for the sake of a crop that did no good and much harm to people's health as well as to the land, not to mention the political and moral effects of relying on slavery for a labor force. But to Virginia's planters, even to so inventive a man as Jefferson, there appeared to be no alternative. In fact, an alternative existed right under their noses. German immigrants, farming in the Shenandoah Valley, had a much different relationship with the land from that of the planters of English stock. The Germans had not received huge grants of land from the English king or the royal governor. They had bought their land in relatively small holdings. Coming from a country with a tradition of keeping the farm in the same family for generations, even centuries, they were in it for the long haul, not for quick profit. They cleared their fields of all trees and stumps, plowed deep to arrest erosion, housed their cattle in great barns, used manure as fertilizer, and practiced a precise scheme of crop rotation. They worked with their own hands, and their help came from their sons and relatives. No overseer, indentured servant, or slave, man with little interest in the precious undertaking of making a family farm, was allowed near their fields. Although Jefferson did not comment on the German farmers in Virginia, he did compare the planters' practices to those of European farmers and explained that the Europeans were much superior in agriculture for a simple reason. It results from our having such quantities of land to waste as we please. In Europe, the object is to make the most of their land, labor being abundant. Here it is to make the most of our labor, land being abundant. In the years following the Revolution, life on the Virginia plantation had much to recommend it. There was the reality of political independence. There were the balls and dinners, the entertainment. There was freedom of religion. The political talk about the nature of man and the role of government has not been surpassed at any time or any place since, and at its best, the talk could stand to be compared to the level in ancient Athens. Life at Monticello in the years after the Revolution was delightful to the eye, ear, taste, and intellect. Just imagine an evening as Thomas Jefferson's guest, following a day of riding magnificent horses over hedges, fields, and rivers, chasing fox or deer or bear. The entertainment would begin with toasts to the successful hunters. The table would be groaning under the weight of sweet potatoes, peas, corn, various breads, nuts, quail, ham, venison, bear, ducks, milk, and beer, all produced locally. The wines would come from France and be the best available in America, personally selected by Jefferson. If it was a large party, there would be conversations in French, Italian, and German, as well as English. Jefferson would play the violin for the Virginia Reel and other dances when he wasn't talking. Most guests found Jefferson to be the most delightful companion they ever met. He charmed and delighted his political enemies as well as his friends. "Spent the evening with Mr. Jefferson," John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary in Paris in 1785, "whom I love to be with." He later added, "You can never be an hour in this man's company without something of the marvelous." Before the election of 1800, Abigail Adams wrote of Jefferson, "He is one of the choice ones of the earth." Jefferson's guests were also choice. Whether from Europe or America, they were men of the Enlightenment, well-educated, intensely curious, avid readers, and pursuers of new knowledge of all kinds, but especially about natural history and geography. They were politically active, thoughtful about matters of government, full of insight into the human condition, and also witty conversationalists, quick with a quip, full of hearty laughter even when the joke was on them. Life on the Albemarle plantations after the Revolution had something of a Garden of Eden quality to it, but there was a snake in the garden. The glittering social, intellectual, economic, and political life of Virginia rested on the backs of slaves. Those backs were crisscrossed with scars because slavery relied on the lash. Not every master whipped his slaves. Jefferson almost surely never did. There is no evidence one way or another with Lewis. But every master had to allow his overseers to use the lash whenever the overseer saw fit or felt like it. Slavery worked through terror and violence. There was no other way to force men to work without compensation. This was the other side of the coin of one of the proudest boasts of the Virginia gentry. They claimed that they knew how to lead, that command came naturally to them. Edmund Burke spoke to this point. Although he disapproved of slavery, he observed that slave owners were among the foremost in asserting the rights of man precisely because they were slave owners. "Where there is a vast multitude of slaves as in Virginia," he observed, "those who are free are by far the most proud and jealous of their freedom. To the masters of slaves, the haughtiness of domination combines with the spirit of freedom, fortifies it, and renders it invincible." Thus the sting in Dr. Samuel Johnson's embarrassing question, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" No man did more for human liberty than Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence and of Virginia's Statute for Religious Freedom, among other gifts to mankind. Few men profited more from human slavery than Jefferson. No man knew better than Jefferson the price Virginia paid for slavery, most of all in what the system did to young men. In Notes on the State of Virginia, he wrote, "The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part, and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it. If a parent could find no motive either in his philanthropy or his self-love for restraining the intemperance of passion towards his slave, it should always be a sufficient one that his children is present. But generally it is not sufficient. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to his worst of passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. The man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances." Jefferson knew whereof he wrote, and he knew no prodigies in this matter. Slavery was critical to tobacco planters because their agricultural practices were so wasteful and labor-intensive. Slavery prospered in the American South in the decades after the Revolution because of technological progress. By the time Jefferson became president, the steam engines of James Watt had been applied in England to spinning, weaving, and printing cotton, which led to an immense demand for that staple. Simultaneously, Eli Whitney's cotton gin had made it practical to separate short upland cotton from its seeds. Slaves and land were necessary to grow cotton. The land was available in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. The slaves were available from the excess on the Virginia plantations. These were the central economic facts in the life of the Virginia gentry, whose principal export soon became slaves. Profitable as it was to him, Jefferson hated slavery. He regarded it as a curse to Virginia and wished to see it abolished throughout the United States. Not, however, in his lifetime. He said that his generation was not ready for such a step. He would leave that reform to the next generation of Virginians and was sure they would make Virginia the first southern state to abolish slavery. He thought the young men coming of age in post-war Virginia were superbly qualified to bring the American Revolution to this triumphant conclusion because, as he said, these young men had sucked in the principles of liberty as if it were their mother's milk. Of all the contradictions in Jefferson's contradictory life, none exceeded this one. He hoped and expected that the Virginians from the generation of Lewis and Clark would abolish slavery, even while recognizing that anyone brought up as a master of slaves would have to be a prodigy to be undepraved by the experience. And it should be noted that, as far as can be told, he said not a word about his dream that young Virginians would lead the way to emancipation, to precisely those young Virginians he knew best, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Jefferson did not marry until 1 year short of his 30th birthday. Lewis never married. In this, they were unusual. As Jefferson noted, very few of the gentry pursued their studies to their 20th year, for they commonly married very young and were soon encumbered with families. They had to give constant attention to the management of their plantations. Attitudes toward and relations with women are central to every man's personality and character, but seldom discussed, especially among 18th-century Virginia gentry. Jefferson, who wrote about almost everything, wrote little about women in general and almost nothing about his mother or his wife. Lewis never wrote about his mother. An exception in Jefferson's case was his remarks about the contrast between American and Parisian women. In America, Jefferson rejoiced, women knew their place, which was in the home and, more specifically, in the nursery. Instead of gadding frivolously about town as French women did, chasing fashion or meddling in politics, American women were content with the tender and tranquil amusements of domestic life, and never troubled their pretty heads about politics. Foreign travelers tended to agree, at least to the extent that they found Virginia women dull and insipid. Denied any role in politics or the management of the plantation, surrounded by a small circle of household slaves, the women of the Virginia plantation tended to become indolent, self-indulgent, frustrated, and unhappy. The great ornithologist Alexander Wilson, in an 1809 letter describing a southern trip, commented, "Nothing has surprised me more than the cold, melancholy reserve of the females of the best families. Old and young, single and married, all have that dull, frigid insipidity and reserve which is attributed to solitary old maids. Even in their own houses, they scarce utter anything to a stranger but yes or no. There were obvious exceptions, Jefferson's daughters, for example, and Lewis's mother. In general, however, it seems the men who ran Virginia plantations in the years after the Revolution missed an essential part of the human experience by denying themselves, or by having denied to them, a full, open, mutually respecting relationship with women. By contrast with the white women on the plantations, Wilson observed, "The Negro wenches are all sprightliness and gaiety." Winthrop Jordan, in his masterful study White Over Black, American Attitudes Toward the Negro, speculates that the dull frigidness of the white plantation women was hardened by the utter necessity of avoiding any resemblance to women of the other race. Jordan further points out that, on the plantation, the traditional European double standard for the sexes was subject to caricatural polarization. More sexual freedom for white men meant less for white women. Whether Lewis indulged himself sexually with his female slaves or not is a subject on which no evidence of any kind exists. That many masters did so indulge themselves is a commonplace, with evidence aplenty in the form of mulattoes. Whether Jefferson so indulged himself is the subject of much speculation, argument, and controversy, all of it based on very little evidence. The most the scholar can say with confidence 2 centuries later is that the nature of Jefferson's and Lewis's relationships with women is almost unknown and unknowable. Jefferson wrote that, had Lewis stayed with it, his talent for observation, which had led him to an accurate knowledge of the plants and animals of his own country, would have distinguished him as a farmer. But although he was good at it, Lewis ran Locust Hill only out of necessity, not desire. What he wanted to do was roam and explore. On May 11, 1792, the American sea captain Robert Gray sailed into the estuary of a river he named for his ship Columbia and fixed its latitude and longitude. Jefferson, who had twice since the winning of independence tried to sponsor an American exploration across the continent, proposed to the American Philosophical Society of Philadelphia that a subscription be taken to engage a daring traveler to undertake an expedition to the Pacific. George Washington subscribed, as did Robert Morris and Alexander Hamilton. On hearing of the project, Lewis approached Jefferson and, in Jefferson's words, "warmly solicited me to obtain for him the execution of that object. I told him it was proposed that the person engaged should be attended by a single companion only, to avoid exciting alarm among the Indians." This did not deter him. Jefferson's high opinion of Lewis apparently did not extend that high. In any event, he passed over the teenage Lewis and chose instead a French botanist, André Michaud, who got started in June 1793. But he had scarcely reached Kentucky when Jefferson discovered that Michaud was a secret agent of the French Republic, whose chief aim was not to explore or collect natural history specimens, but to raise an army of American militia to attack the Spanish possessions beyond the Mississippi. At Jefferson's insistence, the French government recalled Michaud. Lewis, meanwhile, continued to toil on Locust Hill, but he was increasingly unhappy with the sedentary life of a planter. His mother was now well re-established in the family home, and she was fully capable of running the plantation. His desire to see new lands, to explore, to experience, to roam, was insatiable. So, as Jefferson wrote, "At the age of 20, yielding to the ardor of youth and a passion for more dazzling pursuits, he engaged as a volunteer in the body of militia which were called out by General Washington to quell the Whiskey Rebellion." Chapter 3. Soldier, 1794 to 1800. The Whiskey Rebellion of 1794 was the greatest threat to national unity between the winning of independence and the outbreak of the Civil War. The North-South split over slavery had nothing to do with it. The struggle pitted West against East. The precipitate cause was simple enough, a new tax. Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton wanted to increase the power and extend the reach of the federal government. In addition, the government needed money. Hamilton therefore laid an excise tax on whiskey, the principal product of the Trans-Appalachian region. Those at the frontier felt neglected, misunderstood, mistreated. There was little or no hard cash around, yet Hamilton demanded a tax paid in currency. A tax on whiskey was a tax on what the frontier made and sold, not on what it purchased. Exactly the objection the Founding Fathers had raised against internal taxes imposed by England before the Revolution. More generally, the frontiersmen complained that the government attempting to collect the tax neglected to provide Western settlers with protection from the Indians, failed to build Western roads or canals, and favored the rich absentee land speculators, the biggest and most important of whom was President Washington himself, over the simple, hard-working frontiersman who was trying to acquire land and build a home. The frontier farmers revolted. They refused to pay the tax, they shot at revenue officers, they tarred and feathered revenue officers, they burned down the houses of revenue officers. President Washington, alarmed at these symptoms of riot and violence, called out 13,000 militiamen from Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland in August 1794 to quell the rebellion. Washington needed volunteers because the regular army, with an authorized strength of 5,424 officers and men, was in the Ohio country on an Indian campaign led by Major General Anthony Wayne, launched in response to two successive, humiliating, and costly defeats suffered by the army in Ohio. In 1790, under General Josiah Harmar, and in 1791, under General Arthur St. Clair. Those Indian victories had inspired widespread Indian attacks on frontier settlements, which in turn were among the causes of the Whiskey Rebellion. On the East Coast, men might fear a standing army. In the West, they clamored for one that could protect them. On August 20th, 1794, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers,